Just to remind you about where we are.
We are in the Mishnah that created the responsibility for people to contribute with their own funding for the maintenance of communities, for the wall that they have to build for defense, and for the gatehouse and the gateway at their courtyard. And this was all in relationship to a story that came in a brisa that said, well, does that gatehouse really effectively keep the poor out? And are you withholding your required contributions of tzedakah from the poor if you build up all these structures around you? It's another way to read the Gemara, the first part of the Gemara, in relationship to the Mishnah that we started on. Ultimately, we get into conversations about what is a community obligated for? And when it comes to the social welfare, the poor particularly, poor being a dynamic term, again, many different types of poor recognized within that term in rabbinic literature, not just one type of poor. And therefore, a community has the obligation to at least create what's called a kupa, and we're going to call that the tzedakah fund, the charity box. A tzedakah box is called a kupa in Hebrew. And it's going to require a tamchui, which is a soup kitchen, which is prepared food, meals for those who are in need. Now, I said we're going to start on 8b2, but I'm going to back you up one little page on the English packet to 8b1, because I see the beginning of the braita is on 8b1. And again, in the Vilna, it's Tanu Rabbanan, Kupa Shel Tzedakah. Okay, so the Gemara is going to begin right-hand column 8b1, down three-quarters there towards the middle of the page. The Gemara discusses the rules for administering two charities mentioned previously in passing. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbi is taught in the Mishnah. Remember, Tanu is the term for the Braita that... Or it's a Mishnah itself. And so here you have the Mishnaic term, Tanu Rabbanan. They taught in the Mishnah, and you see the Mishnah is Peah 8:7. We learned that, remember, from the books, from the Mishnah Peah. We already saw this. On the right-hand column now on 8b1. Okay, so the Kupa Shel Tzedakah, Nig Beit Vishnayim, contributions to the charity box, which is a general fund for the poor, are collected by two people. So you're talking about the collectors. Umit chaleket b'shlosha, and the funds are distributed to the poor by three people. Now the interesting piece there is that if you think about what three people represent in the tradition,
Beit Din.
Is a Beit Din. And so you ultimately want this to be a measure of justice, that we're redistributing this money to the poor. So the symbolic nature of the three who are distributing is not lost on us. Nigbe b'shnayim, contributions are collected by a delegation of at least two people. She'ein osim sararot al tzibur pachot mishnayim. For we don't establish an authority over the public consisting of less than two people. Umit chalek b'shlosha, and the funds are distributed by the panel of three people. Kedine mamonot, as in the case of monetary law. Turn the page now. Tamchui. Just looking at Arashi for a second to see where I want to bring him in. Tamchui. Nig Beit B'Shlosha Mit Chaleket B'Shlosha. For the soup kitchen, the communal, as they say here, platter, this communal soup kitchen, collected by three and distributed by three, the Gemara explains why. Shegvuya v'chiluka shavim. Its collection and its disbursement happen, shavim, on the same day.
Same day or equal?
It's on the same day. That that the collection and the distribution being the same day makes it shavim.
So why the cash cannot be distributed in the same day?
It might very well have to be, based on some realities that might face you if you're actually part of this administration on a daily level and you take account of who has meals today and who doesn't and who might need to buy himself or herself some food if I don't have enough in the soup kitchen. So there's a little bit of flexibility built into the system that's going to come now. Here's how it works. The Braita now presents distinctive laws of the charity box and the platter, meaning the soup kitchen. Tamchui v'chol yom. Food from the communal platter is distributed once a day. Kupa me'erev Shabbat le'erev Shabbat. But money is really distributed from Friday to Friday. In other words, what's the money for? Hopefully that the soup kitchen provided the weekday, the money will be for Shabbat. Now, also, if you see here in the English, it says, paupers who had food for several days but needed additional money to feed their families for the rest of the week would receive supplemental funds from the charity box. So that's built into the Gemara that we're studying now. So what's interesting, just to stop here for a moment, is that you have in the world of social service, soup kitchen reality here in the neighborhood, a very interesting phenomenon. Some soup kitchens, some places that provide food for those who don't have enough to make meals every day, some places, they really do abide by this kind of collective responsibility, one soup kitchen to the next, down, you know, this one over here provides a breakfast. This one over here is going to provide a lunch. This one over here is going to provide dinner. Or this one over here is going to at least give you a bag to dinner. This pantry over here is going to take care of getting you a bag of fresh groceries. And obviously there are ways that social workers meet with the folks at these different venues. Some do that interaction and engagement better than others, and they try to get them on some type of program to get some funding as well, so that if they qualify for something like what used to be called food stamps, they actually get what's coming to them. And they have the systems to help track whether or not people are really receiving these things. So it's an interesting kind of reality that in one location or one neighborhood or another, the systems might work a little differently depending on who's doing which piece, and, by the way, whether or not they're speaking to each other and they can coordinate. Here it sounds like there's one communal institution. And you have to wonder whether or not there were any places that were so big that they needed a little bit more of a communal structure that had any number of them at any given time, and what that greater council or greater organization looked like within that framework. But they don't deal with that piece here, but I'm sure as a spur to the call to action, the Gemara is suggesting that perhaps it would be better to be centralized and to try to understand who these poor are within your community and take care of them through this central system, than leaving every courtyard to have a little sign that says, breakfast here on Tuesday, or lunch here on Wednesday. Because I'll tell you, one of the problems that I had noticed before we started some work in this community with getting people together who didn't really meet one another. We created a local neighborhood coalition of folks who, not only from the agency side, but from the churches, synagogues, where they would come to the table and some of the food pantries. They didn't realize that even the map, because there already was one map of where you could get a meal at what day and at what time, it was already done by the Neighborhood Coalition for Shelter, but it was already outdated months after the last printing had been circulated. And so you have the on Yehair, the impoverished folks around here who are depending on all these places to be able to go, and we have a proliferation of them on the Upper East Side, so we would have both our own neighborhood folks and folks coming in from other neighborhoods taking trains here, subway here, and really depending on our area because of the wealth to really be treated to these things through the churches and through some of the non-religious organizations. So we had a movement towards getting that map put together in a better way, a more updated way, and with some visuals in addition to like 7 or 8 point type to list it all. Because people didn't have their glasses that were necessary if they had eyesight problems. Some people literally couldn't read. And so we had to suggest doing it in a visual way, like this color for breakfast, that color for lunch, this color for dinner. And to put like one letter for Monday, Tuesday, or TH for Thursday, not even to write it out, 6 point type near the spot, just so that we could kind of think about who are the poor, who are they in a human way, who do we need to reach, how do we reach them, what do we have to put out visually, what do we have to write, and where are the gaps? And we mentioned even last week, Stephen Grimaldi from New York Comic Pantry, his staff was instrumental in kind of saying, wait a minute, where are the gaps? And can we fill one of those slots? And then another group took and filled yet another slot for meals. So in today's world, it doesn't look exactly like the Gemara is presenting it in our very populous part of New York. But this idea of creating such an organizational system and treating these folks with the dignity they deserve and giving them the food they need and having some sense of distribution and understanding when the distribution of the food is not enough and you have to add supplemental funds. This is the Gemara. This is the Talmud. This is the code that brought this to life. Right here, in just few words, this is the spot. So when I think of a little bit when I'm doing this work, about the pride we can have in the rabbis systematically coming at this inyan in the world, this matter of hunger, and this matter of getting people their due in this way. These are the spots in the Gemara, the large 63 tractate. These are the couple pages that introduce that, with all of whatever else we've learned over the last couple of weeks. This is the spot. So to me, it's unbelievably compelling. We haven't even read through the end of this little piece yet, but it's even more compelling now. Let me read through the end of the piece and then we'll get comments.
I don't know if we'll go back into Kupanik Bet Beshnayim, but if in the case of a Kupa and somebody is giving money in Matan Beseter, then there is no witnesses.
What do you... So you got to translate for people.
Matan Beseter is to give money in secrecy. So there is a kupa, the tzedakah book. So people put money with no witnesses because it's secrecy. Nobody wants to know that you put the money. So the question that I have is the kupa need to be opened by two, or do I need to bring my witnesses that I put the money there? How they did the fact-checking about the giving between Matan Beseter and the collection that people go from house to house.
I mean, it's a very good question. Even in the part where it's going to speak about giving anonymously, because we'll get to a part in the Gemara that's going to speak about that a little later, there's not as deep a detailed answer to what you're asking. Meaning, if I really want to give fully anonymously, am I allowed to say to the two collectors, leave the kupa open, or the door to the tzedakah box open, and at some point I'll slip in and I'll put it in there, right? In general, if we think about the kupa as a locked tzedakah box that I can leave somewhere, and the two people...
No, I have two options. I have two options the way I envision it.
Right. So at least two options, right? So if you want to envision one of those options, we could say perhaps something like that did happen. Perhaps. That's not specified here. I did see a wonderful tshuva one time about tzedakah that I taught when I was for a year honored to be the gabbai of the Hebrew Union College Tzedakah Collective in Jerusalem. Every year there's a new group of rabbinical students, and they have this tradition of having started a tzedakah collective. Not only does it collect funds to distribute, but sends people on all kinds of volunteer opportunities and helps students coordinate volunteer opportunities. Okay, long story short, we did some learning there. There was a tshuva that talked about if someone wanted to give anonymously, entirely anonymously, leave $1,000, you know, in the tzedakah jar. Is it that the Gemara is suggesting that anonymous only means so much anonymous, but that the two collectors have to understand where every gift is coming from because of other rules that say that money cannot be stolen money, that money can't be unkosher? In other words, how far do you go with allowing anonymous to be anonymous? Is there a responsibility or an obligation for people put in charge of charitable funds to understand the source of every dollar, just like we would hope that they are responsible in evaluating where they're actually giving money, and they're responsible in a certain sense, having a board that checks the way that they program and distribute and all these things. So this tshuva seemed to indicate, and I'm trying to remember exactly where we saw it. We might have studied it with Danny Siegel, whom I mentioned was the gabbai of the Ziv Tzedakah Fund that he started. You know, the suggestion here was that you need to know where every fund, every bit of your funding is coming from, especially for large gifts.
You know, there's just a side story. Abu Chatzira, the young Abu Chatzira in Ashkelon, his community or his kupat taka had $100 million. $100 million. They found out that it was a laundry machine. It was a complete system involving the police and everyone on the tape. And it was a crazy scenario. So
yeah, it's unfortunate sometimes that these things are part of the systems, you know, and you can really make treif very kosher systems. Okay, let's finish the little piece here on the left-hand side still, if you're with me. It goes beyond that, where it's trying to figure out how someone's getting enough food or enough funding. We're on 8b2. On the left-hand column. It says, Tamchui, the soup kitchen, le'aniye olam, the soup kitchen is for any poor person. Literally, aniye olam, the poor of the world. Meaning, you have Jews in your community, you're going to give the Jews. You have non-Jews in the community, you're going to give, they're poor. And here is a very generous moment in the systemic setup for the distribution of funding and food to the poor. Is mentioned that you should be obligated l'aniye olam, to the poor of the world.
So kupa,
what's that?
Non-Jews as well.
That's right. Kupa, the tzedakah funds, though, the ones you collected, le'aniyei ha'ir, to those who live in your city. Now, what does that imply? What do I have to know? Not necessarily the passers-by. Those who, in a sense, have
residence
and or have registered in some way, or we know of, through the authorities. Now, it gets a little gray here. Watch how it gets a little gray. if I know that a tamchui is for the poor of the world and the funds in the kupa are for the poor of my town, now listen to this. V'rashim b'nei ha'ir, the officials of the city council, la'asot kupa tamchui, are authorized to render the charity box funding for the soup kitchen. So really what's that saying? I can take and make my money that's set aside for B'nai Ha'ir, for the Oniyei Ha'ir, for the poor of the city, I can make that more universally available food funding. However, I could also do the opposite. V'tamchui kupa. If I need to, I can take from that which would provide for the tamchui to make sure that my city poor are covered. And I do that because, if you look down below, this is an interesting piece, and I'll in the Rashi, read you what he's got. Okay, hold on one second. Vasot kupa tamchui. It's in the second narrow line. L'chalek l'aniye olam im yirbu alehen. To give to the poor, just the any poor beyond the poor of the city you know, if they happen to increase among them. And in the English notes, said in not so few words, if a particular city receives an influx of paupers from the outside, thus overburdening the resources of its soup kitchen, it may provide for these poor with excess funds from the charity box, even though this money is normally reserved for the local poor. So you have some fungibility, is the point, within the administration of these two very particular funds, and it obviously requires the authorities to speak with one another and figure out, are we covered? What's the census? You know, I was, for New York City, involved over the last few years listening to how we take a census of the poor of the city, and especially of the homeless. And so there are mechanisms in place for the administration to really try to figure out how many folks were really experiencing in the city, looking for food at the shelters each day, and looking for food at pantries, and looking for food through the food stamps programs, and who have really said, I have some food insecurity, or I am impoverished, living under the poverty line, especially, and then we make distinctions in the census between those who are senior citizens and those who are not. So all this has to be part of the work of the B'nai Ha'ir, in this case what we call city council, that local small council who we don't know so much about in terms of the policy they make and what they administer, but we do know that this is part of it. It's not a tractate, for instance, on everything they do. So we find where they are mentioned and we see that this is part of their real job. Just so that's, again, part of the systemic governmental network of agencies and agents who have responsibility in the name of the people of the city. By the way, so I'm mentioning that, like, we might take it for granted, but I'm just reminding us again, like, shouldn't take that for granted. That's Talmudic culture. That's the culture that's developing in what we've called the polis. As cities are developing, city life is developing with more systems of ethical attachment and moving from that agrarian and agricultural sense of what tzedakah is, this is really the moment. This is the recorded, as I said last time, the minutes of the committee meetings on how we're going to do this. Okay, Bryce is going to add this general rule. Ulishanotah l'chol ma sheyirtzu. Listen to how general and broad that statement is. And they are authorized to divert excess charity funds to any purpose that they desire. Now, you can look at the footnote and say, wait a minute. Because the question is, really? Any? Footnote will add that the Rim Migash and the Rama and other commentators understand that the Gemara is authorizing the diversion of these charity assets only to projects that benefit paupers in other ways. In other words, this money needs to go to deal with the poor. You need to keep it in that bucket. Thus, for example, although money was donated to the charity box in order to provide the impoverished with food, those funds may be used to provide them with clothing or shelter as well. However, to divert that money to a general community project would constitute gezel aniyim, a principle under the law that we don't steal from the poor. Rashi, Tosfos, and Ramban disagree with this interpretation and contend that the diverted funds may be used to meet any public need, since the donors initially intended to rely on the discretion of the charity administrators. And you can see inside some other folks who either go along with this or take it and just change it a little bit. So this is an interesting way of expressing what this money is really all about. If the Gemara meant that the money could be about any communal need, like the communal need for the seeking justice for your poor, then the broader ethical interpretation could be, if I can categorize this endeavor as bringing a similar measure of justice into my city, then I might be able to say in my political science, in my way of looking at the world, that that's the case. If I want to limit it to the context of my sugya, which is tzedakah and making sure the poor have what they need by way of food, and I could then understand, because of the Mishnah that we learned from Peah, that it could mean, okay, food or some clothing or some items that they might need, these impoverished people, I might be able to make that ribui, that expansion, but only that much. So which do you like? Yeah? Do you want to go the larger philosophical way? Oh, a lot of Jews in today's world want to take so many principles and make a very expansive look at what it means to express Torah in terms of Jewish life today, right? So it's not unheard of that we should make expansive kind of interpretations on what seem to be very straightforward principles. I'll give you for instance. Somebody might, in the world of Tefillah, Masechet Brachot, is talking about how the morning, the afternoon, and the evening prayer are established. One argument in the Gemara is that those are rooted directly to the Avot, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who established them. One is saying that it's parallel to offerings in the temple, and the language we use of the prayers now is in place of both the prayers of our ancestors and or the sacrifices we made. Prayer is now linguistic, embodied in the Amidah, embodied in the liturgy that has been passed along from those thousands of years. And we ought to, till this day, really engage in that kind of prayer. Others, expansively, and this is not exactly the same, but I think you understand why I'm using the parallel, would say, I no longer need to be loyal to any kind of liturgy whatsoever. Jewish prayer doesn't require me to relate to any Amidah. That the bigger idea is the search for the relationship between me and a God who, by the way, doesn't command me to actually engage in the practice of mitzvot. I can't live with that tension. That's not the Jewish God I can imagine. And so, I interpret prayer as being something very different than that. And yet I call it prayer. Right? So, tzedakah same way. If I sense that my search for justice is the overall search for righteousness that I sense in the world, and I dissociate this kind of funding that's available to me from dealing with the issues of poverty vis-a-vis hunger, food, and clothing, I can be very expansive in my look for what's righteousness. So some seem to make more sense, what's more righteous than another kind of pursuit. Of course, I could say that maybe providing some type of care, medical care maybe, or nutrition education is very close to these things and therefore a righteous way to expand it, but very much within the spirit of it. But what if I say that a sports league is really what's essential? And I take the money out of my tamchui and out of my kupa, and I say, life can't be without sports, because life can't be without sports. How far do we allow for the seeking tzedakah enterprise to really be interpreted? And that gets to, and then I'll take your comment, that gets to the why there's an argument or a discussion among Rashi and Tosfot and among people like Migash and Ramah in a footnote packed with both sides. Because you have to figure out just how expansive sometimes you want to be in your ribui, in what's called a ribui, the word rav, that wide, how much you want to expand any principle or any kind of legislative piece of systemic law.
But they're giving somebody, they're giving people the power to, once the poor of the city are fed, if there's extra money, then they're giving these people the power to figure out how to spend the rest of the money. So it depends on who these people are, really. I mean, the same thing now. It depends on who they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As to how they're going to spend this excess money.
What you're picking up on, Rana, is a nice part of what the Gemara is going to address, and that is, who are these people?
Yeah.
And what do we say about them? And do we trust them? And what about their reputations? And how do we hold them? In what esteem do we hold them? And so you'll see that the Gemara really wants to strengthen our trust in these folks whom we have appointed and whom we grant permission
to spend our money.
Right. So you'll see that. Bobby.
So I'm wondering, most rabbis nowadays have a discretionary fund.
Correct.
So as someone who's in charge of a discretionary fund, do you see it falling into this model in terms of how you will do it? I mean, is it for the poor or is it for anything?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a piece that I was really working through later on, and I said to one of my teachers at Ziegler, because I'm preparing this, I think I mentioned to you that I was talking to my teacher, Dr. Aryeh Cohen, who's a Gemara scholar at Ziegler Rabbinical School and American Jewish University. I said, what do you think about finding texts within the Gemara that can really help rabbis have the right kind of outlook on their discretionary funds from the materials that we're learning? Because in fact, there's a piece that really deals with the issue. Turn the page over to 8b4. I made note of it, and I'm actually starting to take a few notes and going to propose to Aryeh that I at least Skype in, if not get over to LA to talk with rabbinical students just about your question, Bobby. So Abaye relates certain practices of his teacher Rava that concern communal charity matters. So Amar Abaye, Abaye said originally the master Rav would not sit upon the mats belonging to the city synagogue, right? So he wouldn't even sit there because they had been purchased from public funds and he felt like there was a misuse of the funds. Kevan de Shema'a l'ha de Tanya. However, once Rabba heard that which was taught in the Braita, Ulishanota l'chol mashi yirtzu, that city officials are authorized to divert excess charity funds to any communal purpose that they desire, Haviyativ. Abaye would sit down. Meaning, within the ethics of the Gemara, if those funds come in and they are considered the extra tzedakah I'm presenting and there's an administration of those funds by a trusted official, in this case some trusted officials because they're the administrators of the kupa and the tamchui, which are different than, yes, an individual rav, but you do have to see that an individual rav here was deciding whether or not to sit on those, and by the individual rav deciding to, yes, at the end, understand from the bright that there's enough trust within the system to spend for what he would consider, or they would consider to be really purposeful spending for a community, then I think that a Rav could think expansively about what it means to spend communal funds. Never to forget that at the core, they are tzedakah for people who have less. Food, clothing, shelter, a dress for a bride, a pair of sneakers for a kid, some type of help in that regard. But sometimes the mats for a shul really make a difference. And to make a decision about how to beautify an ark, for instance, which is one of the decisions I'm making now, mm-hmm. that the aesthetic committee has been working on, to say that I think some communal funds to really show kavod la Torah and to create that experience within our Beit Knesset that is inspiring because of the way we have the aesthetic there, that's an okay use sometimes as well, depending on how much I would have. And here's where the question is, hey, Rabbi, do you see that as, you know, accounting for a little extra? Because are you being true to some of the ethical dimensions of what's in this set of pages as an administrator of, quote-unquote, the public's funds? So I do think that this really relates to being someone who distributes tzedakah dollars.
Why isn't it that the rabbis, if they're doing the commentary on the laws, are not part of those three people that govern the...
I think they very well could be. But in this case...
No separation.
But in this case, you're pointing out something very interesting, Ari. It did not say that it had to be two of the rabbis. It did not say that. It didn't say they couldn't be. But there's an openness to have B'nai Ha'ir in this case be representatives that come from various, quote-unquote, communities among community members, which, again, every time the rabbis do that, it's very conscious. Speaking of Dr. Cohen, every time you have someone who's not called Rav, and we had this with one of the students who disguised himself, if you remember, that one manuscript dropped his title.
Right.
These are very conscious decisions within the production of the text. There's a Gemara in Bava Kamma where someone's instructing us on how to come up with the potential net value of a worker so that workers' compensation can be paid if someone injures a fellow friend. Okay? Take him to the slave market, figure out how much he would go for, figure that he's got X number of years of life, figure out how much that would be generally, you know, worth. What if it's a child who got hurt? Drag him to the market. And the voice that comes to object to that is the avuha de yanuka, is the father of the youngster. And the rabbis, in that way, create some self-reflection, if not self-criticism, every time that they invoke the voices that are serious voices that sometimes challenge their own policy decisions or their own halachic decisions. So in this way, interesting that it didn't say that they were rabbis, interesting that it didn't say, more specifically, who those members possibly are. We know through a Gemara elsewhere that the B'nai Ha'ir were elected in some way We don't know what the election system looked like or what the voter booths really looked like at the time. But we do know that they were not simply appointed, but that there was some sense that the community really agreed. Unlike the elders, who might have been more picked, hand-picked from this council, and became the Zekenehi here.
So if I'm talking about the cash, the kupa, the obligation is to distribute for each person equally, or each person will get different if they stand in line, let's say, on Friday afternoon, to get money from the kupa.
It's an interesting question, Ron, because in some places you're going to see that a person has to be treated according to the way that he or she experienced life, so too should they be provided for. Mm-hmm. We have that kind of charitable ethic. But I imagine what we're talking about here is a more equitable distribution from these funds.
Because it says on page 8B2, in the first column, that they figure out that they give certain money and then they give money to families.
Right.
So obviously, it's a different amount.
Yeah.
It would be a different
amount. I mean, so on that level, you do, I think, have some even distinction within the fund. Thank you for pointing that out. So you do have people thinking about the different needs and what could be. Let's talk about these communal leaders more. Left side, still getting to your question, Bobby, as to the ethics we learn, no matter who we are involved in charitable work.
Are we still on B2?
Now I'm going back to 8B2. I'm going back to 8B2. Bottom of the page on the left side, the Braita concludes by enumerating other powers of communal leaders. V'rashayin b'nei ha'ir lahatnot al hamidot. And the city officials are authorized to stipulate regarding to measures. In other words, that they can decree that a specific volume measure be made larger or smaller. Okay? So why would I need to do that? If I have less flour and I say, you're getting a kav today, but my kav is a little kav minus X, I might have to do it. V'al ha-sharim, and regarding the prices, they can make a whole change in the system. And v'al schar po'alim, regarding laborers' wages, in this case, Rabbeinu Gershom, you see the note says, decree that laborers be paid less than the prevailing rate. Now, it's interesting whether or not that really means be paid less than the prevailing rate when it says, you know, al schar po'alim.
Yeah, but this is alanat sachar. It's against the Talmud. You cannot not pay the employee.
You can't withhold wages the day of, and you should pay them as much as you think a fair rate is. But if the city official knows that there's a going rate for something in town for the last 3 weeks, but we have a couple more poor on the books this week, and we need to spread it out a little bit, that's, I think, what it's trying to say. Trying to
but
get
if somebody produced, gave labor to earn salary, you cannot pay him less than the deal.
Well, you're creating a perush. You're creating your commentary on that line to say you can't do it. But Rabbeinu Gershom is saying yes, you can.
Lahasia al kitza.
Right, you can't withhold.
You can't pay somebody for making labor, but you can adjust the rate.
No, what the rabbi is saying is that today I will pay you 70%, and that's the end of it. And that's
the officials have the power to say that that's okay.
Pay labor. You show up for work and they say today I'll pay you $10 for work. The next day maybe.
No. He already labored and now you give him less than what he's expecting.
We're also making a scenario there where that we don't know what the scenario is in this case.
It doesn't say he already worked and then you stiff.
Yeah.
So
that's an interesting thing. You may indeed understand that, and you may say that's what you can't do. So these are how Gemara commentaries are created sometimes. Ron is saying, if the guy worked all day and he thought he was making 11, but now you're going to give him 10. No, don't. You're not allowed. But if you would have heard from the officials from the beginning. So then you're agreeing.
Because
I think what Rabbeinu Gershom is saying is that from the beginning they can change the rate.
At the end, he's waiting for his paycheck.
Yeah, at the end, I'm saying that wouldn't be so nice. I agree with you.
Because they say the Allah Sharim, that means that they're allowed to change the rate.
Mm-hmm.
That means they changed the rate after the rate was established.
No, that's only in the way you're reading.
These are day laborers, so the answer is we're paying everyone $3 Okay, and that's what you're getting. And all of a sudden, you realize the crop's getting there, your warehouse is getting there, and say, you know, we really can't afford to do that anymore. Okay, today, we're paying you $2.50
Right.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And it's done at not an individual level, but a town level, because the towns are setting this or whatever, a community.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether this is a 10-person town, 100-person, 1,000, 100,000, but it's some group in there, and there's some communal. They don't want people undercutting wages,
right?
There's a standard at some level.
It's interesting you brought up the olives example, because I was reading a piece about this part of the Gemara, and people thinking, like, are we talking about money, or are we not talking about money? Are we talking about the produce that they might have been helping with to bring it to the different folks who grew all kinds of fruit and all kinds of products in the ancient world? And then I don't know has anybody seen the Jerusalem exhibit at the Met?
Yes.
You saw the pile of gold coins that were found off of Caesarea?
Couldn't miss that.
It is really something to think about, that, you know, there was a whole system of, there's actual monies and coins. But I think sometimes what we are talking about is kind of, you know, wages do not necessarily have to mean money. We have to get out of that habit of mind that wages only mean money. So the olive example. Lahastia al kitzatan, and the officials are further authorized to fine those who transgress the stipulations. Okay, now these officials have a big responsibility, obviously, and they have to really figure out what's in excess and how to really make enough of a distribution and how to get this into the hands of those who are in need. So skip the next two paragraphs and go down to where it says the Gemara stated above that collecting for the charity box must be performed by at least two people. Okay. My siraruta, what element really of authority does collecting donations for the charity fund really entail? Let's talk about the authority they have. The Gemara replies, "Da'amar Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Bar Avua." There is nevertheless an element of authority. Rav Nachman said in the name of Rabba Bar Avua, because collectors are authorized to seize a pledge for an unpaid charity obligation, and even on the Sabbath eve, you know, where someone's not going to chase after you per se and come knocking, banging down your door. Now, Gemara objects to this statement. Any? Really? They can go seize it? This is, what do you call that? When people take the car, they repossess. You're allowed just to go and, it's not exactly repossessing, but in a certain way.
Impound?
If you philosophically believe that all they're really doing is helping you redistribute the great goodness of God above. They're repossessing. So, V'hakativ ufakadati al kol lochatzav. Is it not written, this is a Jeremiah verse, that evil upon all of their oppressors, V'amar Rabbi Yitzchak bar Shmuel b'mart mishmei derav, and Yitzchak the son of Shmuel, the son of Marta, the son in Rav's name, says, V'afilu al gabayei tzedakah, and God will visit evil even upon charity collectors. What? Who behave in this kind of brutish way. Since collecting that which the people are required to give is not oppressive, indeed, it is a great service to the community. Oh, but it could be interpreted a different way. That since collecting that which the people are required to give is not oppressive, indeed, is it a great service. Rabbi Yitzchak must mean that the collectors occasionally oppress the people by overzealously seizing their property for collateral. So that's his whole Hava Amina. And for that we will be punished. We see then that the collectors are forbidden to seize pledges for unpaid charity obligations. The Gemara replies, Lo kasha. No. It's not so difficult. In other words, we don't say that they're going to have evil visit upon them because they've done some type of brutish seizure of resources. And as a matter of fact, my statement stands that they're allowed to seize certain tzedakah pledges. How? Not a difficulty. Tad'am here, because this is when the contributor is a wealthy person. It's not oppressive to seize that property. Ha'de'lo'ami. But this law of Rabbi Yitzchak applies that they shouldn't be so brutish when what? When they're not so wealthy. So the Gemara relates to an incident to illustrate that wealthy people are indeed treated differently. Ki hadarava, and it's in the case of Rava, achapel Rav Nathan Barami, and while he was collecting for charity, coerced Rav Nathan Barami, a wealthy man, v'shakil mine arba mea zuze litzdaka, and took from him 400 zuzim of charity. So thusly what? You're allowed to seize it if you know he's got it. Now, didn't say he had absolutely pledged, but of course that's what it implies, that he pledged it and he wouldn't give it up and they needed it, and here he took it. Now, some parts of the system are very informative about how we should live and do work today. If someone makes a pledge to the shul and I walked in and I took their checkbook and I wrote it, this would be above and beyond what anybody could allow, even the most righteous lahavdil, charity collectors, to do. This would be a little difficult. But have you ever felt like you were dealing with someone who was a little bit overzealous in their asking for a little tzedakah?
Yeah, my favorite joke is the couple that's marooned on a desert island, and the woman is hysterical. You know, she's going to die. And the man's totally calm. And she says, what are you so calm about? He said, don't worry, I made a pledge to UJA, they'll find us.
Right.
So, I think that's it. They find us.
It's a good classic joke.
Can I retrace this back? And let me just ask you, I don't know if I get this idea that one person can't be over everybody and two is okay. So what does that mean? I thought maybe that when they said there have to be two people, it meant that it kept the one person honest. If you have only one person doing it, it's
like... Don't think by two, that it's like two witnesses. You need two witnesses to have justice, so to speak.
Right.
So you need to always have two...
Right.
So one will not...
Well, you're talking about the massive fund, however, is it 1,000, is it 2,000, is it 50,000 or 100,000? You brought up the question before, population-wise. But when you're talking about the large fund that is going to really take care of the B'nai Ha'ir, in terms of their obligation, on behalf of being representatives of the people, to really fulfill the obligation, what they're putting is obligation to treat the poor with this dignity and dignify them through food especially, and at least clothing. So they're coming up with ways to do it that both talk about, yes, two people do it and it keeps each other honest, so that the whole B'nai Ha'ir doesn't have to be involved in counting one by one by one the poor people of the place, of the city as well. In other words, there could have been a council of 18, not just to be honest, but to do all the work. Part of that, I think, gets into the whole notion of, is there consistency among the people who are doing this work, who will ultimately be your best bridge to the human beings at the other end of the receiving side? So the two, on the one hand, it's all about ethics and honesty. On the other hand, it's about their particular familiarity with the work that needs to happen and the people who are receiving it, so that it's not a revolving door, it's not a huge group, oh, I thought he was doing it. You know, when you're two people and you're really responsible for this.
No more than two is what they're saying, too.
Well, I don't know if they're not saying no more than two. They really are saying these are the two. But I think there's a lot of potential angles for why it's two. One is they keep each other in check. Moreover, they're doing the work every day. They know these poor folks. They know the other administrators who are only three. There's a smaller group to do this work that is essential work of the B'nai Ha'ir, who are the quote-unquote elected officials for everybody out there. And they can keep very, very particular tabs on where it's gone, what's happening, who's got it, which poor we have registered here. Do we understand who the poor of the world are in our community, on the Olam versus on the Ha'ir, the poor of our city? And without that kind of keeping it, I would imagine that once it gets too unwieldy and numerous, you really can't have a great administration of these funds. And the amount that it represents is an amount for an entire polis, if you will, regardless of how big the polis really is. And so it's very essential that we understand in some way that these numbers are about the individuals themselves, and the Gemara is going to get into that. The Gemara is going to spur individuals to be excessively pious and put them in a category of being wonderfully pious, even if they're not rabbis, by the way, because they weren't, again, required to be rabbis, at least in our texts.
The collection is by two, but the distribution is by three.
Right. And the administration of it is by three.
Right. When it comes to the...
They say it's like a Beit Din for a monetary...
Right. We said it, that it's that level of Beit Din because... Again, we want this to be a measure of justice in terms of what our city stands for. Okay. All right, so furthering the conversation, I think the next little piece is pro-development officers. Like, so this is where like a development officer can feel good about his or her work, and if you've ever done any development as part of a development committee, or you've been an honoree and done development work, or you have a commitment to tzedakah and to the, you know, really righteous distribution of your own quote-unquote extra funds or tzedakah funds, you should know you're in a good category of folk. And so this is going to get into just this piece about, you know, who are these people, and what do we have to be, really, how do we regard them? So it says, "V'hamaskilim yaziru k'zohar harakia," and the wise will shine like the radiance of the firmament. Beautiful verse. Daniel. So, "Ze dayan shedan din emet lamito." This is referring to a judge who renders an absolutely truthful judgment. The Gemara expounds on the verse further. Umatzdike harabim kochavim la'olam va'ed, and those who make the many righteous will shine like the stars forever and ever. Elu gaba'e tzedaka. This refers to charity collectors. So here's your development. If you're going into the world of development, this is the text you need to understand that you have a real place, because you're sitting right next to the judge who judges in absolute truth. And you're a development person, and you're collecting tzedakah, or you're a gabbai for a fund, you're right here. And then, b'matnita tana, it was taught in a braita, v'hamaskilim yaziru k'zor harakia, the wise will shine like the radiance of the firmament. No, in terms of that verse, ze dayan shedan din emet lamito v'gabbai tzedakah, This refers to a judge who renders an absolutely truthful judgment, and to charity collectors, who matzdikei arabim kechochavim la'olam, and those who make the many righteous will shine like the stars forever, elu melamdei tinokot. These are teachers of children. So yet another category of people who can feel that they are doing this incredibly holy work. The Gemara asks, Kagon man, who, for example, fits the description of a teacher? Amar Rav, Rav says, Kagon Rav Shmuel bar Shilat. Like Shmuel bar Shilat, who relates this story about Shmuel bar Shilat. The Rav Ashkechela Rav Shmuel bar Shilat, the Havikai Beginta. For Rav once found Shmuel bar Shilat standing in a garden. Amar Le Shevakte Lehemenutach. Rav says to him, have you abandoned your trust? In other words, where are your students? We know you're always teaching. Amar Le, Rav Shmuel said to Rav, Ha Tleisa Shnin Delo Chazyali. It's been 13 years and I haven't seen this garden. The Hashtanami De Atai Ilaihu. And even now my mind is on my students. Even now. You know, I'm not out to just take a stroll. I'm thinking of being an educator, how to educate, how to teach, how to put out those lessons. That's righteousness. So after revealing the tremendous honors these worthy people will receive, the Gemara then says, turn to flip it, the Rabbanan Mai, and what is written about the rabbis who study Torah constantly? Gemara says, Amar Rav Avina, V'o'avav ketzeit ha-shemesh bigvurato. But they who love him shall be as the sun going forth in its might. And so the Torah scholars also have their place. So Torah scholars, though, here, very much parallel level to teachers, judges, and tzedakah collectors, development professionals. And that's a very, very strong statement for what it means to have a kehillah. This gets back to some of the basic structures of what the Jewish polis would have to have in place. You must have a court. The whole notion of these numbers may indeed be simply like a parallel. Remember when we learned Gittin and there was a debate as to whether or not a Beit Din could be two or three? That you have to be as righteous as possible. So maybe there was a group that was five. And maybe in one community there was a sage who had a discretionary fund. Maybe the extra funds went to that one sage, and he decided what to do with it. We don't know exactly that this is everywhere. As we said, these could be the minutes of the development of systems, and some of the other communities might have had some other ways of dealing. But the notion that there's embedded the sense that tzedakah is a measure of true justice, Din Shadayan Emet, a judge who judges truthfully, that a gabbai has to really be like that judge who judges everything truthfully, that a judge who judges truthfully has to be like a gabbai and give tzedakah out with his decisions in the court, that the teachers of children have to judge each child meritoriously, like a tzedakah collector collects the lessons that he needs to give children, she needs to give children, and distribute them righteously, like a judge sometimes between two children who, you know, every now and then there's going to be an issue. You've got to act in this way, like the development specialists around to collect. So I think that there's a lot of overarching play on the ethics and the buildup of Jewish society. You need a school, you need a courtroom, you need collectors.
You need a soup kitchen.
We're talking about the kehillah developing here. And it's developing in a beautiful way, and it's putting a lot of people up on that level. Whereas, wait a minute, before, right, we were a little annoyed. Why were we annoyed in certain parts of the Gemara to begin with in terms of the sugya and its development on a literary kind of way? Because didn't it sound like the rabbis were placing themselves into a different category altogether when they were removing themselves from actually having to pay into certain projects?
Yeah.
Right? So my claim on the literary read of the Gemara, by way of if you think about Gemara sometimes in a narrative way, is that, oh, here we have a very different presentation of the Chachamim and who they really think themselves to be part of and not just apart from. and they really see themselves as part of this very holy group of community officials who are doing the most work to ensure tzedakah in the largest expansive way and in the very particular way that's written in this policy part of the Gemara.
So the second sentence says that the Gabbai is so tzaddikim that they need always to go together to make sure that nobody
leaves. Right, but what I'm suggesting is that if you take that... What I'm suggesting is, too, is that if you take that hyper-literally and not see the measure of justice within it, then you're right, it kind of falls down. But what they're really trying to achieve is a systemic justice.
The system needs to be.
That the system
also
is...
Also the appearance. They said that they shouldn't look like one is alone. They should look together. Because they are, you know, they are concerned about the appearance of something, even if somebody would be impeccably honest alone.
That's the reason I asked before, when do you open the tzedakah
right.
box, do you need to have two people opening the tzedakah box, or one?
Right, right.
That's exactly
right.
Why I raised the question earlier.
Right. So, by the way, just to get back to your question about what if it's one, and we do have a discretionary fund. This is very open news here. So there's two ways to actually write discretionary funds policy-wise within synagogue structures. Either you can have a private checkbook, and then you can have an accountant who's not associated with the board at all to keep some level of anonymity, which again will become an issue later in our Gemara, because the real hope is that you would want to have some level of deep anonymity in the disbursement of those funds. And you go through with that accountant once a year and you audit. Okay? That's one way. Another way is, like we do it, is that the account is under my discretion, but the checks are not signed by me. That everything that goes through, and I, each year or each set of years, have one person who is privy to those checks coming through. Now, that's less anonymous than the other alternative direction.
Yeah, but the Gizbar, who checked the Gizbar? Every time you write a check, it's come to you?
No.
So, they can write checks without you knowing.
That's true. I have no idea of knowing.
But you have an audit.
But you have enough of an audit to know, and you have to have enough of a balances and checks within the whole system, because then there's the whole system of the audit itself, that we have outside auditors come, and do the checking that way. So it's an interesting policy discussion by way of tzedakah collectives, as to how many people they have on their development staffs, and how many people they have doing the disbursement. Does the Gemara's policy in this section that we just learned require less than more? In other words, if we kept to the quote-unquote letter of the law here, if we thought of this as only letter of the law, we might say that the kupa is collected by two and decided upon by three. But what if I want my group of collectors to be 12? You know. So in that spirit, no one has held in halakhic sources that I know that you must have to set out this way, and you must have only three if you've got a fund organized, either within a city, a la the UJA, or something like a Ziv Tzedakah Fund, or a Kavod Tzedakah Fund, or a Good People Tzedakah Fund, or whatever, one of these great tzedakah funds that distribute a lot of wonderful charitable donations.
We infer that you must have more than one?
Yeah.
We infer that you must have more than one.
I think we infer that there's got to be a system whereby more than one person has access to looking at the history and distribution of both gifts and distribution of charitable funds.
What's interesting is that there isn't developed a directed donation structure, that this is all communal, collective, and obviously we have learned that directed donations often are more easy to achieve.
Hmm.
But you know, that's a whole other topic.
Well, it is a whole other topic, and it's not a whole other topic. This has become a very big issue in the Jewish world today, because it's an issue. I think it's always been an issue. The Gemara does relate a little to it, not here. And when people have what they consider to be kind of pet projects, but it's at the expense of the community, then the Gemara has a lot to say about the ethical nature of that decision. And in giving circles, that's a real problem, right? If I only want...
Huge problem.
Yeah, if I only want this and I'm not willing to pay for the infrastructure of the hospital, then how will I ever achieve that kind of greatness? So those are really big issues. On the other hand, the Tzitz Eliezer, who's a modern day authority, 20th century authority, once answered a question and said, vis-a-vis this funding being extra. Yeah. If I wanted to donate something very specifically in memory of someone because that item really spoke to the heart of the person whom I want to remember, and I want to suggest to my synagogue, can I please create this? My let's say, you know, Olav Shalom, my father loved being at the Torah, and that new cover we need, Rabbi, you know, I must have that in my father's memory. Write his name on it, don't write his name on it, whatever the shul policy, that's very generous, by the way, right? Whatever the shul policy. Please, let me donate this. You can suggest it, but you have to be open to your gift being received or not. So that's the formula that's kind of used in that tshuva. So it's an interesting piece.
Yeah, one thing that sort of started to blow here in my mind is a communal tax where everyone is obligated to put money in. And when you talk about food and clothing, which is more seductive, is it voluntary or is it a tax? I mean, it's...
Right. It is blurry, Fred.
Yeah, I mean, it's a voluntary tax. You're obligated to give seductive. Right. So, internal, I feel, you're not obligated. You know, once you are obligated, it's more of a tax fee, something like that, than seductive.
Yeah.
And it's blurring back and forth here.
Here's a piece that I'm trying to figure out as I read through the Gemara again, with that question in mind. On the one hand, we could say that some of our distinction between those two as Jews might be coming from our understanding of taxation versus tzedakah as it exists from our 1040 or stretched forms, where we have to declare, like, some contributions are charitable contributions, and then other spending is not even spending I can write off, and what's a charitable contribution and what's not, what part of a dinner can I write off, what part of it can I not, right? Some of that might be. So if I were to throw that out and take care of getting the distinctions between the charitable contribution and the fee that I pay for food, what have you, and all the 20th century, 21st century stuff about the tax code here, I'm left with the question whether or not the rabbis in this moment of history and recording the debates and the policy making and the systems thinking and the halacha about it, whether or not they are thinking about tzedakah in such a way that truly does lead to the expression of taxation as a form of fulfilling the mitzvah we are required in the Torah.
But you cannot use the word taxation in the mitzvah.
Oh, yes, you can. Because, again, we're not burdened or bogged down by the way we think of taxation in today's world. I'm throwing that out. I'm wondering whether or not in rabbinic literature that the creation of communal obligation vis-a-vis money, called taxation in our English idiomatic translation, isn't the way that the rabbis start conceiving of tzedakah fulfilled in the way that tzedakah is fulfilled in Torah. Remember, moving from the agricultural to the city living. So if I am a farmer and I'm obligated to, quote unquote, leave the corners of my field, pay the tax right. to the poor, because that's my product and that's my income. Like I have money here and I have to cut the corners off and leave that and pay into communal funds to have the food that's necessary for the poor to respond to needs that come up. And I want to call it something other than just say, you are obligated to give tzedakah, because that's the idiomatic parlance that the way we speak today. But the rabbis needed to figure out the way to actually say to you, here's your obligation, here's the way I'm going to put that out there, systematized. It's called this communal tax, and it's not just a communal assessment for something I might need. Like, the defense one seems to me to be assessment, but this tax seems to me to be fulfilling the tzedakah requirement of Torah. Then I'm blurring the lines on purpose.
There almost be three different categories evolving here, you know, like a police force, walls around the city, a synagogue that needs to get built, or sewage. It's almost like that is a tax or an obligation that you have as for living there as part of the community. And the second is, well, we have a town, an obligation that we have to feed the poor people. That really is not a obligation of a citizen. That becomes tzedakah, but we're going to manage it so that that's part of your tzedakah obligation, but we'll collect it for you in the terms of X number of dollars, a room, a house, whatever that number is that they're obligated mm-hmm. to collect.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third level of tzedakah is beyond that, where the radiance comes beyond that,
mm.
where you know, every dollar people pay here in taxes goes to feed the poor, okay? You may not think of that as tzedakah, but that is being done by our, but beyond that is a different level, and that's just sort of how I'm
yeah.
starting to associate it at almost three different levels, two of which are called tzedakah, but yeah, when I write my tax check, I'm not really viewing that as charity.
Yeah. Yeah.
But clearly some of that is going to that purpose in a global sense.
Right.
When they speak about the fact that they can reallocate funds to other purposes, I'm having the reverse sort of experience that Fred is having. To me, it's a matter of semantics. What we nowadays call tzedakah, we're speaking about doing something nice for somebody. Charity, we would call it. Whereas I'm having more of a general sense now that tzedakah is a matter of, in effect, good citizenship. In other words, everyone in the community is required to put a certain amount of money in. And the way those funds are designated or used is up to the people who are making those decisions. But it's tzedakah whether it's something that goes to charity for people who have no money, or whether it's money that's being used to fix the roads. So
yeah,
it's a matter of, it's an overall sense of understanding your responsibility to the community.
Right, but the difference between tzedakah and taxes could be punishment if you are not obligated yourself to. Tzedakah is, they cannot go after you to punish you for them. So it's all goodwill of the citizen. Because if you will force tzedakah to be part of the taxation, basically it's the base of communism. Whatever is yours is mine, and whatever is mine is mine. That's basically what it is. You cannot do that. And the religious concept is not like this.
In a righteous society, it's not a problem at all.
But they cannot punish you if you give less or you don't give.
Well, in a righteous society, no one's not giving.
That's
so
correct.
It's not an issue. But, the studies show that people, when they give philanthropy, actually have their pleasure centers in their brain light up.
Good.
I haven't seen any studies on it, but I doubt that anybody's pleasure centers light up when they give a tax.
So
that's why the mitzvah makes you feel good, but
obviously the trick is in a righteous society, people get the pleasure center lighting up when they're giving the tax, which is there because they now associate that with acting.
So Barry, if I have a tzedakah box that has a little scanner, and I feel so obligated in my mitzvah that I never really get the same pleasure as someone who feels like this is the extra and beyond. So there's where that breaks down for the Jewish people, right? Because I could feel so obligated.
You don't have a good development office. If you have a good development office, everybody who's paying the tax is feeling the pleasure set the light up, because they framed it in a way that makes the person understand it's the centrality and the importance of the contribution and why they should feel good about it, despite the fact that it's taking money out of their pocket. And I realize this is a bit of a, intellectual leisure domain, but I see it at work. I mean, I see how people who frame things in this context really can pull that off. And it's not just a trick. It's the way people think about what they're doing and the rewards and feelings they have about it.
It's a blessing for people who value this. When they're doing this, you know, you've got a certain group of philanthropic people that are brought around to it. But now you're talking about everybody in this community, which is...
That's why I started with the concept of the righteous society.
Well, but it's hard to find everyone righteous. I've had a lot of arguments about that in the Bible.
We all want to live in that society.
I was going to come back to that example, actually. There is a notion of collecting that which were there required. And so for the rabbis, what we have to realize is that regardless of the pleasure principle that could be involved here and the greatness of the development office, that's why I think and it's wonderful work to take these categories and try to figure out, which element is what, and can we use the word tact differently than we can use tzedakah, and even are the rabbis really saying that? But there is just a certain base level of obligation to a principle of Torah, to a mitzvah, a category of mitzvah, that all this is kind of being developed for. And therefore, there is still fuzziness in my mind, and it comes down to the obligation of tzedakah as a policy mode for each of the areas that you were able to kind of separate out, and where it, I think Jay, where you're putting it back together, right, is that space of the rabbis having a certain sense that all this is obligation, and what's interesting, if you go down to where Barry was with the difference in the mind, that is like the perfect definition of kavana, right? That on the one hand I can get the pleasure principle out of giving that element, and on the other hand I fulfill the obligation, and that's probably another map that I could see in the scanner. And those are really, I think, part and parcel to the entire system and the approach of the rabbis for mitzvot itself. There's certain keva elements, standardized, obligatory parts, and there's that certain kavana, the meaning-making, the inspiration, the pleasure that comes along with it.
Very much like what's happened to our understanding of the word mitzvah, which has come to mean, oh, he did it, it was a good deed, it was a nice thing he did, but traditionally a mitzvah is a mitzvah because it's commanded.
Right.
And it seems very much the same thing here.
Right.
I agree with what you're saying, that it's very much, a piece of it is intentionality. What's the money being used for? Somehow if it's being used to build a road, I think building roads is a good idea, but I don't feel quite so altruistic and virtuous in the way that I would if I fed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it completely parallels how we perceive a mitzvah today versus
today. Right. I think that's very, very, very much plugged in with the tenor of the conversation about the Gemara, the interpretation of mitzvah.
Yeah.
just wanted a clarification. When are these equal amounts that are, does everybody give the same amount when you say this, you know, kind of mitzvah tax?
Give?
That they have?
Are you talking about the giving side or the getting side?
The giving side.
Oh, the giving side.
Or is it dependent on how much they have so that it is a little more?
I mean, there seems to be some debate about whether or not there's a head tax with a certain amount or there's some type of tax on the income. Or wealth.
We don't know which it is.
I mean, it seems to me that...
Well, it was very definite.
Seems to me the rabbis are also playing enough with both having been a possibility in any given spot for the way that they had to take care of business, let's say for the roads, or this other kind of need in the community, so that we're not given a definitive answer as to how each one of these is achieved. But it seems more logical, if you will, that people can only give according to their own means. And in order to achieve the kupa weekly and the tamchui, the soup kitchen, and the fund weekly, that we probably have to accept the fact that different people have different levels. Hopefully, in the righteous society that we're talking about, they're actually being honest brokers with their own, what's my obligation.
You don't need the goodbye.
And you don't need the goodbye to come banging down your door, taking what you pledged, brutishly, but that we can all kind of be in this space righteously.
On page 83 again, it says, it tells the story of Rav Nachman Bar Ami.
Right.
He was coerced.
Right.
So it wasn't, doesn't sound like it was so...
righteous.
Yeah, it wasn't so voluntary.
Oh, and by the way, talking about one of their own, again. So could be that they're bringing themselves into this culture and saying, you know, right, and that we recognize,
they don't need to do this.
And we're willing to say about ourselves that this is not always easy to achieve. I'm not always going to, maybe because it's not such a virtuous project in my eyes, maybe because I just have a hard time parting with my funds, even though I even pledged it. But they're driving us into this more ethical dimension of life, fulfilling this mitzvah for sure, which I think at the core does have an obligation at its core, and it should only be that we get great inspiration, making sure we're fulfilling the needs that are potentially sustained by our tzedakah moves. Let me just finish with one little piece of text before we go, and that is... a piece, we read this little one at the beginning of this before, on the right side of 8b4. You know, he wouldn't sit on the mats until he realized that the Brisa said that they're allowed to divert the excess charity funds. Look at the next paragraph. Abaye relates a second practice of Rabbas, bottom of 8b4. Amar Abaye Medresh Hava Avidmar Treki say, originally the master would make two purses for donations he collected. Chad L'Aniyei D'Alma, one for the money distributed to paupers. V'chad L'Aniyei D'Mata, and one purse to hold money to be distributed to the poor of the city. Rab originally kept separate accounts and some contributions were designated specifically for the local poor. Kevan D'Shima'a L'Hada Amar Le Shmuel L'Rav Tachalifa Bar Avadimi. But because once he heard that which Shmuel said to Rav Tachalifa Bar Avadimi, Avid Chad Kisa, make one purse, both for those of the world and for those of the locality. Ba'at Ne'ala, and stipulate with the community regarding it. He who nami avid chadkisa va'atne Allah, Rabbah also made one purse and stipulated regarding it. And even so, Rav Ashi was able to simplify further. Rav Ashi amar anat nuye nami lo tzarichna. Rav Ashi said, I need not even stipulate with the community. Dechol deka'ate, for anyone that comes to donate money to the city's charity fund, which Rav Ashi administered. Ada'ata didi'ate, comes to donate with the understanding that I shall distribute the funds at my discretion. Ulaman deve'ina yahivanale, so I may give to whomever I wish without stipulating beforehand. So there's a level of deep trust that the rabbis are really hoping for, even if, number one, in some stories the rabbis can't bring themselves to actually fulfill the pledges they made. But at the core, they're willing to say, we are going to take on the notion that we've got to do this with the trust of the community in mind, and thus everyone in this system, if I just want to, everyone in this system really is expected to live up to that kind of standard. What's beautiful to me also in that ethic is that the Aniyei D'Alma, the poor of the world, are collected in with the poor of the location, of the city, and that you can really take from these texts about that issue that we have to have and extend, we have to have enough funding to do so, obviously, to take care of our own and to take care of beyond our own. And so, nitchazek, we should be strengthened with the learning to be able to do that.
Or as my mother would say, if you're not getting charity, you have to give charity.
There you go. Even, and who knows, they say in the...
The implication.